in various areas, something that needs to be done to increase that productivity. And even that productivity will put a situation where 70% of the population seems to have the lowest number of protests. Probably that's the result of our past. So it's something that we've got to look into as to, is that what we want in South Africa? Or we want a different situation where 70% of the population is going to be represented by a very small percentage, and a smaller percentage of South Africans is going to be represented by a very big population. Though we are all South Africans, it's not a question of who is there, but it's a question of do we have enough doctors. The second challenge that we are seeing is that there's a lot of people that are living in South Africa having qualified in South Africa. South Africa hasn't spent a lot of money on them, then they just live in South Africa. Is there a reason why they're living? Probably you'll be able to answer that. Is there some problem?
Not a problem, that's the question. I just wanted to ask, I see here we only have the Western Cape, University of Western Cape, but I thought it would be like off.
No, I think let's leave it to them. Let's leave it to them. Oh, okay. We'll leave it to them. To tell us how they're going to do it. So there's an exodus. People qualify, they leave. Is there a reason? Is there something that could be done? There's the quantity and the quality. I'm told, I don't know. But partly the quality of doctors that are producing. It's not very good. I'm not sure. I don't have statistics to what I'm saying. But I'm told by some people that the quality of some of the doctors is not very good. Let me make an example. I'm told that one doctor was seeing a patient who had a pleural effusion and a pneumothorax. And that doctor was saying, let's do a supine x-ray. Obviously, when you want to see the air, you want an erect x-ray so that you can see whether there's air above, and apparently even the doctor didn't know how to put a brain in that. I'm not sure whether this is because the things that we're using are making doctors not to have a good clinical acuity. I'll make an example again. If I see somebody who's in coma, before I do a clinical examination and come with a diagnosis, I just send the patient for a CT scanner. Even before I know what is going on. Because there's so much technology, doctors are not good enough to make their own diagnosis. As I'm saying, this is not something that has been researched, but it's a complaint that has been coming from people that the quality of the doctors are not good enough. Obviously, usually sometimes you produce a lot of poor quality, but good quantity, but we don't have both, we don't have quality. If that statement is true, neither do we have quantity. So we seem not to have enough doctors in South Africa for the number of people that we have. So probably we need somebody to tell us, or maybe we can discuss that. The other one is why we call is the curriculum. Are we having a curriculum that is fit for South Africa? Or are we having imported curricula from somewhere which is not addressing the basic needs of South African people? Probably you might not have enough time to go on to that curricula, but we are interested in knowing whether the curriculum that we have is a curriculum that is addressing the health needs of South Africans. We can learn from the other countries, but we need to have our own because we are our own South Africa. So this is what we need. We don't know how we are going to be doing it, but we said we wanted all the deans of the Faculty of Health Sciences. So we are hoping that you know how you are going to do your presentation. And after that, after your presentation, the members will ask a few questions. But before we go on to that, let's tell you who are these members that have called you to this place? So that I'm sure you're going to forget their names very soon. But as long as you remember, some of them you'll remember the names. We've got a very good team here. They are very good. They know when to fight. they know when to be kind to each other. We are a family of members of parliament. So let me start with the lady that is sitting here, the beautiful lady with the lady that is sitting here is Honorable Dube, great Dube. She had a medical problem. I'm hoping that you are going to help us in helping her in a medical problem. Next to her is the whip of the committee, Honorable Suleiman. You can see he's very calm and collected. He doesn't ask a lot of difficult questions. Next to her is Mrs. Machel. You know the former president of Mozambique. That's a second wife too. No, I'm joking. Beyond her, we've got Umme Mafolo. In her yellow, is it yellow? In her yellow target. You haven't given us what to do in Devon. I hope there's a team from Devon here. Beyond Umme Mafolo, we've got Umzala Wampa. Umzala Wampa. On the other side, I don't know why you're sitting on the opposition side. Remember, you should have been on the other side. Lower down there, we've got Tunda de Canare, Inspector Gates, Honorable Canare. Next to Honorable Canare, we've got Honorable Mike Waters. Next to Honorable Mike Waters, the lady who wants to ask a lot of questions. She has already started. You can call her more, you can call her more, you can call her more in Posa, it's up to you what you want to. So those are the members of parliament. I'm being reminded, who am I? Some of you are going to think that I'm imported from Zambia or Ghana. I need you to tell me, have you done some research to what can lighten my skin so that I become a South African? I want a skin lightener. If you have the research that you have done, that lightener. So I'll be interested. We've got the man who's coming in is our researcher, Uzubi. I thought you were late with this. I forgot to mention that you were celebrating it. You were celebrating it. Next to me, I've got two of your guys who are the secretary for the committee. Those are the people that are going to be asking you questions. So we'll give over to you. I don't know how you're going to do the presentation. Neither do we know that you are all here. But I think I must say, I happen to come from Eastern Cape, and I stay in Mkata. And I've been noticing that there was a territory in the University of Transkei. I'm told that because Tanzania couldn't bring most of the things that he wanted because of the territory that is going on there. So we'll forgive you for some not having some of the documents. But we don't think they took your brain. All they took was your office, but your brain is still here with us. Okay, we'll give over to you.
Thank you very much, Chair. My name is Kaya Penyana. I'm from Water School University. I'm here with the Dean and in my capacity as the newly inaugurated Chair of the Committee of Deans, taking over from my learned colleague on the other side. But we introduce ourselves just now. Maybe we should start with that so that at least we will move forward together. Now, before we do that, we are, how many universities here? Well, we are UCT, we are Stellenbosch, we are Walter Sisulu, and then we are University of KwaZulu-Natal. That's four universities. And we are expecting a colleague from Limpopo to make five. Up to yesterday, we heard that he was coming, so I don't know. I'm expecting him to come in any time. So, five. And then, Chair, we have apologies from three universities. The Free State University, and the University of Pretoria, and Vets. They've tried all what they could, but they just could not make it. And unfortunately, they have not sent the rest as well. So that's basically who is here. Before I probably go on further, I think it's appropriate to introduce the people who are here. I'll introduce myself as Kyle Kenyana from Wakasifulu, the relative dean of the faculty. On my right here, or maybe you should introduce yourself.
Good morning, I'm
Marion Jacobs.
I'm a dean of the Faculty of Arts and Social Sciences at the University of Cape Town.
I'm Gondi Perez. I'm from the University of Cape Town, Deputy Dean.
Good morning. I'm Zainal Sanamanda, Dean of Health Sciences Faculty, Stellenbosch University.
I'm Wim Steuren. I'm from the Nelson Mandela School of Medicine, the Dean.
Thanks very much, colleague. Can I also mention one fact here? You saw our colleague here, Professor Bemforam, coming in now. So just said that on his way here, he met an accident, but we were told that he is in Texas and he is coming. So special welcome, because we are here. We don't know the circumstances, but we just said that. I don't know whether it's the Cape Town Road, which are where you are. I don't know.
I've scanned him to see whether he's not doesn't have problem.
I looked at him when he was coming in, walking, and I was looking to stand up and ask whether he's okay again. Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah.
So sometimes the police have to let him at home.
We may ask a question on clarity, because we've only got documentation from one university. We're going to get documentation from the other universities. And also, if I can just ask, when were the universities invited to present before us? I think it's unacceptable that two universities aren't actually here. What period did we give them? I want to choose. Yeah.
Okay, I think the question of when were they invited, that one is going to come from us. But I think some of the things you'll ask them as you go. I thought you were going to cover everything. And then you were going to cover it. We can press the letter, but we think it, in fact they were invited more than 2 months ago, and they apologized at this particular time because the invitation was too short notice. So we said we gave them this particular date. So, but we don't have the letter here now. But I'm trying to say it's quite a long time.
Well, see, I found it unacceptable then. It's 2 months now that they're not even here. And I think, last time when the Eastern Cape came here, we sent them back because they weren't here as a full delegation. I think we should do the same here. Okay. It's unacceptable. And also, where's the documentation from each university? Thank you.
Okay. Thanks, Mark. So this was for you. Maybe you could switch off your
okay.
Mic. Yeah. I think we sent an invitation quite early for the universities. But before we discuss this, I'm not sure whether the other members want to ask some questions pertaining to us, because I'm just opening up the space for what Mike is asking. Maybe if there are no questions from you members now, let's just ask the investors to answer to that question, and then we'll make a decision. Okay, Maria?
I wonder if I'm we were not requested to produce documentation, and nor were we requested to present using electronic media. The reason why I brought documentation here is really to focus my own mind and to help you to just in summary see what we are up to.
Thank you very much. I suspect when we said we wanted to know, and we've actually spread some of the things that we wanted, we thought each, because they are not working as one, each university, so we thought that each one is going to tell us what they are doing. Now, there are two things, that there's only one that has given us a document, because even the ones that were going to tell us what are their policies, they were supposed to give us documents. And the one that I think probably might have a problem is Wakasifulu, because of the territory that is called on there. That's one problem. The second problem is this one that is being raised, that there are three universities that have not yet. And we want to know what is going on. Did they know that they were supposed to be here today? Have they sent an apology? And this is what we want to decide as members as to whether we go on with this meeting or we don't go on, depending on the answers that we're getting from you. I think that the Hanari, you want to ask your question.
I just wanted to check whether the universities were invited as individual universities or as a collective. Because the apology being presented does not give you a clue about what are the reasons why they are not here. It is said that they did everything within their powers. What does that entail? Doing everything within their powers to come? Were there no planes, or the universities burnt down, or I don't know what happened. If I'm clear on the two, then I can make a recommendation. Because if each one was invited in their own right, we can't say we are punishing you because others did not come. You know, but if they were invited as a collective, and if the reasons of if the everything in their powers makes sense to me, I will have a different view.
Thanks, let me just say, we are discussing a very sort of pertinent issue. When we invited them, we wanted all the faculty of health sciences to be here. And we went through their capacity. And when they said they were not going to be able to come the last time, it was because some of the universities were not ready. But I want to say, can we probably, members, make them answer? And then, having them answer the question, we're going to ask everybody just to walk out for a minute and leave the members to decide what do they do. But before they go out, let them give us the answers, and then after that, we're going to ask everybody to leave, and then we discuss it as members, and then we come up with a suggestion as to how to live on. Yes, Margaret? Okay. Are there any other questions, members, before we give over to them? Memo?
No, the other question, actually, for me was about the documentation or presentation. I mean, it's not the first time we invite faculty of health sciences. So, I mean, it's a norm when you come to present. I know we want to go green, but we still, to some extent, you know, rely on some documentation where you can, you know, answer questions, relate, and all that. It makes life much easier, especially when you talk about important issues that actually face our country. So I think it's also very unacceptable that we don't have documentation. And remember, we used to say we need documentation before we meet, like yesterday, so that we study documents. And when you come here, you don't struggle to formulate questions or whatever. You actually know exactly what it is that you want to address. Otherwise, we'll have meetings that are not effective forever. Next year, we'll still have the same problem the other year. I mean, by the end of the term, we wouldn't have addressed any issue except the packages of the presentation, you know, the issues. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you. I'm going to give over to the Dean to try and give us some answers before we ask everybody to leave, and then we can discuss. The questions are straightforward.
Let me start, and if my colleagues can throw up that bit. Chair and Honourable Member, I think we have firstly to say on my behalf and the Committee of Deans, maybe take the responsibility of apologizing. I'll tell you why. We are in a transitional stage. As I told you that I'm new in the position, and then the chair of the Committee of Deans has been Professor Reina van der Merwe on the other side. The first invitation, I think it went to him, to his office. And then I think when the committee then now was, and then I can talk about that, I don't know whether it was the time or what it was not appropriate then. But what I know is that when the office, his office was approached for the second time, I think there was a bit of a delay in terms of getting the letter to me, because the office of the previous chair was trying to get hold of my office, I'm told. And when we got the letter, which was sent beginning of that week, we got it end of that meet. The meeting was for the following week. So, and then I had to say it would be very difficult at that time to coordinate all the things to be available because the notice was short. So I asked the committee section to actually look for another date so that at least we communicate the date to the date. Now we're given 2 days and then they were not, I must say, in terms of the schedules of things, ladies and gentlemen, they were not very far away, but we were prepared to honor them. But now when we looked at the first one, it was too difficult, and still me, I think it was the 9th. And then now the next one from the 9th was the 15th. So there were these guys who were actually not here. They responded, I think, if I remember very well, very early, that, I think one of them, I don't know now who, because I did not know that these things were going to come up here. I have to apologize. That I would be overseas at this time, so I won't be able to come. And in other words, they were there to us, they were genuine reasons. But because we were also anxious to come and meet, we just thought that if the majority of the people are around, are available, then let's come and represent the dean. So if we're aware that every dean has to be here, maybe we have handled the matter slightly differently. That is one. Secondly, the letter which came first was not very clear, on, especially to amateurs who are not used to the system, of exactly what was required of us. And the issue of the curriculum, if I remember well, I did not bring the letter here. I don't think it was in the letter. And what was there really was the issue of the selection. So we knew about the selection. And I think, subject to correction, but I think the curriculum, we saw it when we got this letter. We have been trying to get the office and say, can you please give us the, my office was in trying to get in touch with the office to get some documentation and exactly what is required. And then we got this note fairly recently, 2 days ago, yeah. And that 2 days ago, as the chair has already alluded, is when now if my university was on site. Very difficult for me to get into the office and access the mail. But we tried to disseminate the information, as I say, outside the university. That's why, with me, the documents are inside, could not just get into the office and get the documents. When I saw that there is also the need for the country. So, that's an apology on my side, being new as the chair of the commission, and also the fact that the documentation in my eyes and in the eyes of the colleagues were not very clear. Now, because of that, then we said, let's arm ourselves and come here and also be able to present as individuals, because we know what is happening in our institution. If there's more information which is needed after the presentation, we can still collect information and submit. So can I just ask Dana, maybe you want to say something?
Chair, I have nothing to add other than President Pignana's office, as he indicated, he certainly did approach all the colleagues timeously with regard to the 2 potential dates for this meeting. After the first one we received was relatively short notice. I'm unaware of the reasons why the other 3 colleagues are not here, except for the Dean of the University of Free State that I coincidentally spoke to yesterday on another matter telephonically. I was unaware that he wouldn't be here at the time, but he indicated that the reason for him not being able to attend was that their faculty and university today had their graduation ceremony. I'm unsure of the reasons of the absence of the other 2 colleagues.
Okay, thank you. I think those are the responses. The Nelson Mandela is not better. Okay. You're sitting at the wrong place, so you should be sitting next to the other place. Prof. Fahim will address this to you as the leader. I'm not sure if people do understand the importance of Parliament. we are representing parliament here. It's only that parliament is divided into committees, and I think that three important areas in any country is the parliament, the cabinet, and the judiciary. So it's really important when we call people because we want to know what's happening so that we can report to parliament and parliament can decide what they want to do. We understand that when we were inviting you, we knew that you are autonomous. You are not doing exactly the same thing. The policies of UCT are not the same as policies of FED, are not the same as policies of Water. So that's why we said we wanted a coordinating body so that everybody could be here. And it makes it very difficult when there are some that are not here because we won't know what's happening in their executive. Fortunately, I think I had even your selection, whatever, is different. The way you select in Water System is not the same as the way they select in UCT and so on. So we need to know what is going on in South Africa. And in fact, the other part that we needed to call those who are involved in sending students to Chuba, we wanted to know too, comparing with what we are doing and compare with what's happening in Chuba. Because all we're talking about is the production of doctors for South Africa. But it seems that this we're not going to be getting back. When we take it that you are learned people, so when you are asked to come and tell us about your policies, you would understand that you've got to present something. And we've got to look through it, specifically as been said by some of the members that it should have come a few days before, but we would have allowed you to bring it today so that we can look at it even later. So can I ask you, in fact, let me not ask you, let me ask everybody here, except those elected members to remain behind. And we're going to discuss what do we do now that there are three universities that are not here. And if I remember well, it's FED, it's Pretoria, and which is the FED? And Free State. We're told that they are coming.
Yeah.
We don't know what they are. So can we ask everybody, including the journalists, Memaje, Sentela, Utaria, the group, and I, including the journalists, we just want to discuss this in... We don't want you to go for an interdict. By the time you get the interdict, by the way, it will be finished. Everybody, including CLS, Prospect, there's somebody that I don't know next to you then. He must go out, he must go out. Is he the president of CLS? It's just going to be 5 minutes and we'll be calling everybody. Are we all back? Is everybody who was here back? Unfortunately, we did not introduce. There's a lot of people that we were never introduced, so we don't know whether they are back or not back. But in any case, it doesn't matter. Ladies and gentlemen, we will apologize for having done this to you. It's not that we're looking down upon you. We hope that you'll accept our apology. We have to discuss something. Well, there is a rule, 512, that allows us to sit down as parliamentarians and discuss. But because it was not that much a contentious issue, when some of the journalists refused to go out, we actually left them to this. But we apologize and we really sincerely say sorry to those who left being journalists. It's not a discriminatory way of doing things where we leave, we ask other journalists to leave. But we thank you for living, for listening to us, living. Because we're going to tell you there's nothing serious, sinister that we can say. We're just going to tell you what but some of the sinners remain behind. So it's not that we're forcing you and leaving them. We are sorry about that. And we've got a rule that allows us to do that, but we didn't want to enforce it. We just said they can leave if they want to leave, but we wanted to protect it. Sorry about that, and thank you for sinners for leaving. But God, I'm prepared to talk to you. Otherwise, I don't have a very brilliant mind, but I'm prepared talking to you one by one if you want to do that after this meeting. I'll tell you exactly what was discussed. If you want to do that, I'm prepared to do that because of the fact that you left. We'll discuss the universities as to what needs to be done. Accepting that probably this is the first time that you have been called to Parliament. Probably you might not be aware exactly as to how Parliament works, but be it that may, we take it that if somebody is called here, the interest is for them to present and tell us what they are doing, even if nothing has been mentioned. But when they are called here, it's just to tell us what are they doing with the money, with the taxpayers' money that they are given. But probably there might have been a misunderstanding. But I remember at some stage meeting with Professor Benyana in the plane and telling him. In fact, he asked me, what do you want us to do? And I mentioned a few things as to what we wanted. But the key thing that we wanted in the statement that we sent out was to see all the universities, the Faculty of Health Sciences. And specifically, our interest is that South Africa, up to 1994, has been a divided country on race. And even these institutions have been like that. Now, we wanted mainly, when we're discussing these things, shortage, quality, and all those things encompass where now we've transformed and we're responding to the challenges of South Africa. And the three universities that are not here, which is Pretoria, or Limpopo, I'm always got confused with Limpopo because they said they were coming. So it's Pretoria, it's West, it's Free State. And Limpopo, but Limpopo was not that much, but our interest in this place, those were the universities that were catering for a particular risk group in South Africa. Now we wanted to see whether there have been some policy changes which are actually responding to the challenges of South Africa. And now that the key universities that were supposed to be leading us on that to know whether the policies have changed are not here. We think that we should give you another day to come back and do the presentation. We make sure that we make a proper explanation as to what we want. But any person who comes here, we expect a presentation as to what they are doing. And we know that universities are autonomous. They don't do the same thing. What is done in Waterloo School is not the same as done in West, is not the same as done in another institution. So we are requesting that all of you come here. We are not going to give you a date where somebody is going to be overseas, or our interest would be that if somebody is not going to be here, but somebody must come and represent that particular institution. So we are calling you to not to present today, but we'll give you a date. The secretariat is going to communicate with the chairperson and give you a date. And if there's anything that you don't understand, and that is very great, we are prepared in rewriting it and making sure that every explanation is given, so that by the time you come here, you know exactly what's supposed to happen. Thank you. Yes, Mike?
May I say one or two things? I was as the person that raised the issue, I don't want the deans to think that we are disrespectful of their time at all. We understand they're very busy, but so are we. And I think it's just the relationship has to be mutual. But if I could also request one piece of information, I know you said you're going to write to them, and we hope that each university will give their own individual presentation when they come. But if for example, and thank you, Professor Jacobs, for giving us this presentation. I appreciate it. But for example, here we've got the intake for each year over quite a lengthy period, and we've seen the transformation. I think what's also important, Chair, for us to know is the output from So from the class of 91, how many actually graduated? You know, as well. And I think that's also to give us an idea of where the shortcomings are in the university. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike. I think this is very important because as we are saying that, we want to know how many get into and how many get out. That's very important because sometimes somebody can say, no, I accept 50% or whatever if they are quotas, we don't know. And at the end, you find that it's only 10% that comes out. So we need to know how many come out. That's very important. We are very sorry. We'll give you a date and we'll actually communicate. And we want it, since they are autonomous, we expect this university to tell us what they are doing. Okay. Okay. What did you say?
No, I was just saying we actually appreciate that they are here, you know, because it's not fault of their own that, you know, we just continue with the other universities, but yeah, as a committee we appreciate it.
Okay, thank you. Thank you, Dean.
I don't know. I'm sure that's exactly what I wanted to mention before leaving. I'm glad that Prof. Errol Holland has come in. Because when we're out, I'm not being disrespectful to what you said, Chair. I don't want to have the last word. Just that I wanted to say, he was hung up in the traffic, the same accident where Prof. Durham was. So that's why he's coming in. We'll take that back to our colleagues and to the committee. Thank you.
Welcome, Professor Herbert. Unfortunately, if you are not from Cape Town, you might not understand the topic. We accept your apologies for coming in late. We've set the meeting for another time. And we'll try and make sure that people come early so that they anticipate the traffic of Western Cape. We'll try and make it in summer. So when there's no rain in Cape Town. Okay. Can we have a short tea? Even the deans are invited. The deans are invited to come and have a short tea with us. It's going to be 10 minutes.
Okay, where do we go?
somebody should switch it off. I can switch. I don't know which set to use. Okay, you can. Okay. Do you think I know something? But as you might think that I'm coming from your garden. No, you never miss anything for the better. Thank you very much. There's a fighter in one of the journalists who doesn't like fighting. Yeah, thank you very much. You know that about and one of the reasons why we wanted to more than the president for the president is that, as you know, most of the people, in fact, all of them, they were there even before the democratic system. Now, our interest was to see whether there is transformation in their policies of admitting students in their institutions. And obviously, the three key ones that did not come, your tutorial, your head, and your entry. Some of those that were taken for a particular district ever. So we needed to recall to ask them to live and come there on a particular day. We are of the faculty will be there. And the other thing is that, you know, these faculty members, they are autonomous. They do the same thing. They can never be reported as one person and say, this is what you are doing. We want to hear each one as to how are they feeling at some of it's basically that's the problem for us is about the challenges of South Africa as of now. We don't want something that was done long before, but what are they doing now to address the challenges of South Africa? And those three investigators are key ones. Well, we were not aware that we were not done. It was a surprise to us because we were communicating with the professors. We're communicating with their chairperson on their committee, and we thought that they were all going to come. And in fact, what surprised us is that even the chairperson was not aware that they were not going to be part of the meeting. So what we are going to do now, all we're going to do is to set up another date where it's going to suit all of them. And if they don't come at that particular time, then we'll think of what we need to do, probably legally. But at this time and moment, we think that that's the process of calling them up and giving them another. And be specific on what we want. It was careful. Those of the boys were as in Nebbe Zinga. And where is in Nebbe? It's Kafuri, it's Pretoria,
Members, most of the members still haven't seen. Can we call those that are outside to come back? The journalists are actually invited to.
What's happening outside?
We're going to be the good representative from the Council of Medical Education.
How many can I put up?
Why is it so you can sit.
Somehow There's another lady who was sitting there, I don't know.
I nearly mistook you for journalist.
The
Honorable Dudley. She is a listener in that corner. I was not seeing she's another honorable. You can see we've got so many females. I'm not sure whether I want to start your question. Nothing is. But it doesn't matter. We're going to ask you about your transformation. So welcome, Stella. Really, we just want you to tell us what you are doing, especially with the new weather. The new register is coming with new innovative ideas into the organization or not. So we'll give over to you to present to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Honorable Chairperson, and thank you, Honorable Members, for the opportunity to share with you what we do at the Council for Medical Schemes. You're quite right, Honorable Chairperson, when you remind us that on the two previous occasions when you were here, we had actors, acting registrar, and now the film is finished because a really registrar in place. I'm very pleased to announce that we do have a full-time registrar, and also just to share with you that there has been a new energy in the organization, and we really welcome Dr. Goucher as our new registrar. I also want to take the opportunity just to introduce to you one of our fellow council members and executive committee member and member of the audit committee, Mr. Karim Hussain, to my left here. So you may recall that in previous occasion I was the sole councillor who came to these meetings, and you are probably changing that as an executive team. The process is just to get our new dynamic registrar to introduce you to his team, and they'll share with you different parts of what the council does, and we hope to have a fruitful interaction with yourself as a bearer of soul.
Thank you very much. So we'll give over to the register. Remember, there's one thing that I wanted to mention, just in passing, that we are going to be closing by the way next week. We won't be around, but we have done a draft for finishing the year and meeting the departments. We've got a draft that we're going to distribute to you, and then we can discuss it after the meeting. It's got a draft. You can change and twist it the way that you want it. It's going to be distributed to you. Okay, over to you, Dr. Kassar.
Thank you very much, Chairperson of the Health Portfolio Committee, the Honorable Members of the Health Portfolio Committee. As it has been mentioned, my name is Monodis Gancho, no relation to Monodis Gogwana. It is by sheer coincidence that we've got the first name similar. I'm the newly appointed registrar and CEO of the Council for Medical Schemes, and I'm going to start with the business at hand immediately by introducing the delegation that comes from the Council for Medical Schemes. At the back there, if the member can just raise the hand just to indicate, we've got Dan DeHucho, who is the Chief Financial Officer of the Council for Medical Schemes. Next to him is Tebogo Mazia, who is the head of the Financial Supervision Unit of the Council. Next to her is Craig Barton-Durham, who is the head of the Legal Services, who was the acting registrar before I came in. I joined the council on the 1st of June. Next to him is Dr. Boshoff Steneka, who is the head of the Risk Equalization Fund and Special Projects Unit of the council. Next to him is Alexandra Serva, who is the head of the Communication Department at the Council for Medical Schemes. On my immediate right is Alex Van Jever, who is the consultant and an advisor to the Council for Medical Schemes. With that introduction, I'm going to take you through the presentation in front of you, as you have it on the screen over there. After I finish my question, you're going to have an opportunity to hear each and every one of the senior management who is accompanying me in here in terms of what we do. Let me first and foremost mention up front that for the past 10 years, of our existence as the Council for Medical Schemes, which is a statutory regulatory body created by the statute and by the Ministry of Health. We have, for the past 10 years, had a clean, unqualified audit report.
we should pride ourselves and congratulate the support that we're getting from the members of the council, Professor Peake and his colleagues, and the senior staff members that you have in here. Let me then immediately start by the structure of this presentation is what I've just done now, that the introduction. We'll do the review of the medical schemes industry that is done by the Health and Financial Services Financial Supervision Unit. After that, the Council for Medical Schemes, Budget and Finance, by the Chief Financial Officer, strategic priorities, we deal with the Re-equalization Fund, pricing matters, including negotiations thereof, and other important matters, and then we conclude. The Council for Medical Schemes, as I have mentioned, is a creator of statute. We work and we regulate the medical schemes with the purpose of protecting the beneficiaries, not just the medical schemes, the administrators of these medical schemes, money healthcare organizations, and health brokers. We then maximize the access to coverage of as many South Africans as possible within the private healthcare financing institutions, protect the public interest as an important aspect of our work. We without the adequate regulation that we are doing, being mandated by the Act of Parliament, only private interest would really prevail, reducing access and accountability. The Section 7 of the Medical Schemes Act outlines very important functions of the Council for Medical Schemes. Out of this, Chairperson, you will notice that our work and our primary focus would clearly be placed on protecting the beneficiaries. We then also, in our mandate and in our functions and responsibilities, control and coordinate how these medical aid schemes work. We have to ensure a quality and outcome of measurements of the work that we do. We have to investigate each and every complaint that comes to our attention. To that extent, we have got a fully-fledged department within the council offices, the Office of the Registrar, to investigate these complaints and adjudicate on them. They walk in, they telephone, they email, they correspond to us in many ways, and we attend to those. We collect and disseminate information for the purposes of the public to be aware, to know what their rights are, in collaboration with the work and other information and finding other statutes. We make rules, and the Medical Schemes Act allows us to do this, thanks to the Parliament, thanks to the Ministry of Health. We make rules relating to the functions that I referred to. We, lastly, having coordinated and found all of this work that I have referred to, have to advise the Minister of Health, who then would be directing and working with yourself according to the legislative process. We have to inform because of the capacity and the skill that we have within the council, coordinate all of that information, forward it to the minister so that he can be informed and have a resource based within the creation of the statute in the form of the Council for Medical Schemes. Okay. The last one on the function, which is quite important, is any other function, and I repeat and I emphasize on this, any other function that the minister confers to us, we have to do this. Thank you. I'm going to hand over now to Tebuko Mazia, who will then deal with the review of the medical schemes industry. After that presentation, a number of trends will emerge. After that information, a number of financial aspects of the work that we do in controlling and coordinating these medical aids will emerge. Over to you, Tebuko.
Thank you, Register, and good morning, Honourable Chair and Honourable Members. This slide speaks to claims.
Why don't you bring you to the front somewhere so that you can all see you? We want to see the gentle, but we are talking.
I don't want to see you.
You don't want to see you.
Thank you. claims cost per capita over the last 10 years or so, and you will note that in the last 3 to 4 years, the rate of increase in claims expenditure has been steady, with a spike in 2009. The yellow line is private hospitals, followed by specialists and medicines. Those are the three areas that have grown the most in the last couple of years, particularly in 2009. Solvency trends in the industry. What this slide is trying to show is the impact of GEMS overall on financial soundness of medical schemes. The blue line there is restricted schemes over the last couple of years. And you will see that from about 2006, there's been a marked decrease in the solvency of restricted medical schemes, and that's because of the onset of GEMS, as new members are joining the government employee medical schemes and are bringing reserves with them, and that's resulting in that decline. The blue line there is the overall solvency of both open and restricted medical schemes. We're also trying to show there the impact of Discovery Medical Scheme, which is the largest open medical scheme, on solvency of open schemes. So it's basically showing the two biggest players in the industry and the impact thereof on the overall financial soundness of the medical schemes industry. What we show here is administration fees of the what's called high impact schemes. Those are schemes with the largest number of beneficiaries as well as vulnerable groups, therefore making them, heightening the strategic significance. The red bar represents the number of lives covered by those schemes. The blue line is the admin expenditure. What should in fact be happening is that, in these schemes, the average cost should be low, but it's not necessarily always the case, as you can see. Okay. This shows the overall number of medical schemes in the industry over the last 10 years. Alex, I'm not sure why this is getting cut off.
I don't know how to change it. I think something set in the machine. It's not in the computer.
Okay. But what this slide is showing is the number of medical schemes.
This is what the privileged few decide. Because what is the thing?
Oh, okay. All right. No, that's fine then. This shows the total number of medical schemes and how those schemes have declined over time. There's been a consolidation in the market over the last couple of years. And currently, that's not posing a problem, but should this continue and result in only a few players in the market, that will obviously affect competition in the market. Overall beneficiaries, so it's total lives covered in the industry. The green line shows the trend overall, and you'll see that there's been a definite growth over the last couple of years. However, the blue area is the open schemes, with the orange area being restricted schemes. What is notable is that a lot of the growth happened in the restricted schemes market, and that's largely due to the government employee medical scheme, which is attracting a lot of young and previously uncovered lives. This slide speaks to the estimated cost of prescribed minimum benefits. Estimated cost of prescribed minimum benefits. That line there speaks to the estimated cost in open schemes, which is clearly increasing. The green line is estimated cost in restricted schemes, with the blue line being the overall industry estimated cost. At the bottom there is the estimated cost for GEMS, which has remained fairly static. Basically, what you're saying with this slide is that had there been a risk equalization fund, would go a long way in mitigating, you know, that cost, that upward increase that you're seeing there, and therefore leveling the playing field. This are the sort of complaints that we received in 2009. The unpaid accounts continue to be the biggest area in which we receive complaints. However, an area in which there was a big year-on-year increase is the non-payment of prescribed claims related to PMDs. However, the office has undertaken various initiatives to try and deal with this aspect. And I think that concludes my presentation.
Okay. Thank you, Bill.
Once then the Chief Financial Officer comes around to make his presentation, you will notice, his chairperson and the honorable member, how we go about managing the affairs, particularly the financial affairs of the council, which I have mentioned earlier on, were prepared for the past 10 years, unqualified audit report. You will take us through the budget, from the monies that we receive from the levies from the members of the medical aid scheme. You will then be able to see how we manage the budget and the high cost or low cost budget items that we're having. I'm handing over to you then.
Thank you.
I still giving you the seat.
Yes.
Oh,
we're colleagues.
Oh, you say
that's how we do it in
this
council. Thank you, Chair. Let me also underscore the fact that we've been receiving unqualified audit reports for the successive years. And I think we're doing that because we've managed to institutionalize our internal controls. They apply equally to everyone in the council. And we've got the various structures of audit committees, as we are represented by my colleague Karim, and we've got also internal controls as they are prescribed by the Public Finance Management Act. We've managed to comply with the Public Finance Management Act over the years. I think that is our secret. Chair, I wanted to understand.
Do you get a bonus from government for having a good report?
In 1 year,
the
bonus we get is congratulatory remarks from the former Minister of Finance. He once wrote to us, Trevor Manuel, that we appreciate the good work that you do. I think that was the bonus.
Oh.
Maybe we'll get good salary increases for you from now on. Chair, thank you very much. We just wanted to compare. This slide compares the budget of 2009-2010 financial year and 2010-11. We're indicating that we've operated a budget of 61.4 million in 2009-2010, and this year the budget has increased by about 17%. And the comparative there is that it's 17% because we've taken over this year strategic decision to now fund the risk equalization fund. Previously, the risk equalization fund was funded by a grant from the Department of Health. So as for this financial year, we've now taken it over. We're going to lay the schemes in that regard. As you can see, it's a marginal, it's not a very big increase from the previous financial year. That said, if you compare the levy that we charged to schemes in the previous financial year, we charged the schemes about 15.42 cents. And the other portion that I pointed out was the grant that we received from the Department of Health in respect of the risk equalization fund and other strategic objectives. If we had not received the grant from the department, we would have charged 15.42 cents plus that 274 cents FEC in the 2009-2010 bar. Compare that with the 2010-2011, we are now collecting 18.39 cents
from the schemes as levies. As you can see, there's not, it's not a very big difference. I mean, if you add the trees, about 18 rand, 12, 16 cents the previous financial year, and this is about 18 rand, 30 cents. But we're able to do that to keep the levy to a marginal to a nominal increase, because we had a cash surplus of about 11.5 million. So comparatively speaking, we would still charge the same levy even if we're taken over the recapitalization fund. If you compare our operational functions, in the financial year 2009-2010, we spent about 61.4, and this year we invested to spend about 73.4 million. And also, we're indicating that last year, in terms of the risk policy, the grants we received about 8.6, and this year, in total, about 8.2 million. And the registrar indicated that we are being compared some other functions by the department, and we have taken over those functions, and we're going to fund them to the tune of about 5 million. The business intelligence tool, for example, is going to cost us about 1.7 million, and the single exit price system is going to cost us about 1.5 million. Those are the functions that we transferred to us by the Department of Health. We are no longer receiving a grant from the Department of Health. We are going to fund that through our levy even this year. Let me just point out to some high cost items that actually impact on our budget. We do have salaries, obviously, because like we indicated, we're employing very competent people. We're employing accountants, we're employing actuaries, we're employing lawyers, we're employing doctors, because our industry and our organization is highly specialized. So we're competing very, very closely with the market. So our salary bill, as you can see, has increased. But also, it's because we'll be employing more people this year because of the new strategic approach that was granted to us by the department. But generally, our salaries are on a total cost to company. We've increased salaries this year by about 8%. We're contributing on behalf of our employees, as you know, your unemployment insurance fund and the skills development levy. But also, each and every employee paying his or her own pension fund and pension provision and the medical aid. So it's a total cost to company approach. The rental, the building that we use, we have not bought it. We are renting the building. We've acquired additional space as a result of the expansion we alluded to. And the rent has somewhat increased in this financial year. Legal fees as well. We do receive a lot of challenges on a number of decisions that we take from the industry, and we get challenged. But the legal fees is also a high in terms of our budget. And trustee training is an important aspect of our regulatory function, because these are the people who are actually running the affairs of the scheme. And we go out there and talk to them and emphasize the importance of good corporate governance in so that we do not have a lot of failures in the scheme. And this year, as you are aware, that the scheme 3 has been promulgated and has been effective, we're embarking on a project to popularize this among the scheme, so that, because the schemes also must be run on based on good best practice as it applies to the scheme 3. Those are somewhat the high total costs that I've already pointed out to. I've already spoken to the ingredients that go to the salary increase. We can go forward, Alex. I've already spoken to the rent, that we've taken over additional space because we're expanding as a result of employing new people. And the legal fees also, I've already spoken to that. In our quest to make schemes to comply, we do get challenged, and the trustee training also, we are embarking on educating them. Thank you very much. We have given you copies, hard copies of this budget. If you've got questions, I'll be able to take them from that copy. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you.
Thank you again for that. As we are going to go to the next presentation, you've had, and I think it's important to note the compliance that we endeavor to adhere to all the time, King 3 Code of Conduct, and the PFMA, which is our guiding principle in our financial management. The presentation that you just had alludes to our prudence in dealing with that. I'm not going to call upon Alex, who is going to talk about the strategic priorities on matters that relate to the pricing, health professionals, and how we interact with the rest of the medical aid industry. We will, and we will explain this as we're going along, the whole importance of the reference price list RPL that was struck down by the court a few months ago against the Department of Health and the Minister of Health, and we are currently busy strategizing on how to deal with the industry on behalf and together in assisting the Minister of Health. Over to you, Alex.
Dr. Minister, what RPL?
RPL is the reference price list.
What I'll be doing is running through, I think, some of the conceptual issues that we're kind of trying to grapple with in relation to the price stabilisation within the private health system. In essence, it's a relatively complex issue, and as I'll indicate, it's not an area that can really be left without sort of effective stewardship from public authorities. This just gives you an indication of the surprise increases that we've seen in costs into the 2009 financial year for the sort of the top five major private health activities. So you've got private hospitals, medical specialists, medicine, supplementary allied and health professionals, and general practitioners. The purple component actually just shows you the per capita expenditure, and that gives you the weighting of that expense within the total private system. And the red bar basically indicates the percentage year-on-year increase that we experience in that in real terms, so adjusted for inflation. So what we see is that the largest expenditure item had a sort of a shock 7.5% real increase, which is essentially double the inflation rate in that year. Medical specialists were slightly higher at 8.5%, and medicines 8.1% despite the single exit pricing medicine regime. So those, although there's a very high increase on supplementary and health professionals, they're a relatively small proportion of the overall budget, and a lot of what's spent on that is in the is often in quite restricted elements of coverage within medical schemes, whereas these three elements tend to be in the risk benefits, the risk pooled benefits of medical schemes. So that represents a serious concern overall, and that you can't really leave the market exposed to such high real increase over time. As a consequence, what you'll have is a de-insurance of the market, as essentially medical schemes can't cope with the cost increases in relation to their existing budget constraints in much the same way as the public sector. If we have to look specifically at the issue of private hospitals, which represents a major area of concern, one of the areas that we've identified as a problem, and I'm just highlighting, I think, some of the issues that we would have to deal with before looking at the areas that we are concerned about, solution areas in relation to this. One of the problems that we're facing is really that this is the change in the total number of beds as a percentage of the total number of beds overall for the three major hospital groups, Life, Mediclinic, Netcare, and Independent Hospitals, which is in the green, from 1996 to 2006. If we see that, we see in the certainly major metropolitan areas where essentially most of your medical scheme membership is concentrated, you've got a situation where roughly sort of 12% is left in independent hospital beds after the end of that period, and essentially you have an oligopoly market that's forming between these three groups, which means that essentially you have a structural pricing problem. And if we look at this, essentially the market technically became concentrated in 1998 to 2000 during that period. And what we've seen in going back on the history is that we, during that period, we had a structural change in overall cost of private hospital beds, private hospital costs during that period when we actually see, coinciding with the period of concentration, we see that rise that occurred at a much higher rate than the historical trend, which is on that orange line. And we had that rise, and then we had some stability after 2004, largely due to medicines being stripped out of the hospital cost structure because of the single exit price mechanism being introduced. They could no longer, they could not connect the sort of, hospital groups could no longer profit from the sale of medicines, which they were able to do up to that period. And so you have a flattening for a period largely because of that, and some stability has appeared in cost. And in fact, what's sort of missing here, because of the slides actually, this last one, is we show the big the increase, and we see a new trend emerging, which is concerning, a one-off trend in 2009, which is extremely high. Now, this correlation has been challenged by the hospital groups, but we've noted that when we have a look at the what's happened to profits over this period, we see a coincidence of a period where, in fact, the return on investment, which is the blue bar, also changed structurally in 1999 and rose significantly from what was a fairly stable trend before that. And you've got the cost of debt going down, but you have the return on investment going up. So you have this very, very substantial structural change at the period where the market concentrates. So this suggests, and I'm not discussing in detail yet the challenges of the specialist environment, but this is an indication of one of the structural problems that one has to deal with from a pricing perspective. The other issue is to now just kind of talk about the pricing structures themselves. We kind of have two types of pricing negotiation that occurs in the market. Sort of bilateral contracting, when schemes directly contract with providers, and what can just be termed sort of unilateral determination of prices, where providers basically set a price and the scheme essentially reimburses that price, which is in fact how much of the fee-for-service environment actually operates. So this is pretty much this is your conventional relationship. You have your patients, and your provider sets a fee unilaterally, and the fee, they charge the fee, and the medical scheme reimburses according to benefits. That's one model. And you've got bilateral contracting, where the scheme actually negotiates with the provider, and there's a direct payment. The problem really is that much of the market in this arrangement is very exposed, because there's no real way for the patient to negotiate these fees in a way that actually relates to household and medical scheme budget constraints. And so that's a missing element in the so-called system. So, but essentially, part of the system is also these prices. There are significant complications to the way in which prices are set. They're not entirely straightforward. A part of the price that is determined is in fact the structure of the price. People look at the relative values of a price component. They look at a cost breakdown of those, and then a final rand value. And the problem that we have is that, in fact, when we review something like the reference price list process, we were allowing providers to sit together to determine large components of the final price, but we didn't actually have a way of concluding the overall process in a way that actually dealt with the available budget constraints. If we have to look at the elements of a price setting process, and I'm going to just run through this quite quickly. This is really just shows the complexity of what needs to be looked at in a final system. There are provider prices which are essentially set by doctors, hospitals, and that's what they charge. You have the medical scheme prices, which is a way of sort of defining the price that the medical scheme is prepared to reimburse in relation to the provider price. So basically they say, how much are we prepared to pay of what is charged? And that doesn't necessarily coincide. There's a gap. And that gap is often referred to as balance billing. The balance billed amount, which goes to the patient what the scheme is not prepared to pay. Then we have the RPL process and the reference price list mechanism, which theoretically is really just advice on what the provider should charge, but in fact, there were major problems in how people were interpreting what this should be in relation to these prices. There was an assumption in much of the market that when you set these things on a cost basis, that medical schemes must automatically reimburse the result. And that can never be permitted without actually resolving the relationship between the provider price and the medical scheme budget constraints and private households budget constraints in relation to balance bill demand. Then we've got generalized components of the price. There's a year-on-year general price change, which is also very controversial. Not looking at the structure of any of these things, just what is the inflator. Then there's the code structures. That's what I refer to. People basically look at the actual code structures and in fact how the prices are made up. And in fact how those relativities are made up have severe impacts on the overall amount that is finally charged for a particular professional service. So the code structure is very important. And then you have billing rules, which becomes a further matter. In the medical scheme, for instance, says if you split a bill, which means that you charge the patient the balance bill amount, and you charge the payer, charge the medical scheme the balance, if you split a bill like that, the medical scheme will break down, will not reimburse the provider directly. They will pay the patient, reimburse the patient, and make the provider charge the patient. That's a kind of a billing rule. And there are many billing rules that are, in fact, more complex than that in relation to many services. So these are, all these elements are subject to contentious determination. And there is no coherence in the total system, and the system of pricing is too complex to allow these components to actually be set through collusive practices independently of a coherent process. And the nature of a reference prices process, which is what the Department of Health was taken to court on, can't just be a reference price list in isolation of these elements, because once you've allowed people to sit together to determine a reference price list, you've effectively allowed them to collude in the setting of provider prices. You can't have half a process. So what I'm not necessarily doing at the moment is indicating the specific solutions to these. But what it suggests is that you have to have a holistic framework by which these are agreed, those are agreed, and ultimately the components of the prescribed minimum benefits, which must be reimbursed without co-payment or balance billing, how they are determined, where basically that price must equal that price. So all of these issues really require a coherent price determination process and potentially require direct negotiation in some way that is properly administered and overseen. So this, what we've really been identifying is really looking at a strategic framework for dealing with each one of these elements holistically and not allowing any part of the system to deal with them in a partial way. Potentially, the solution lies in looking at that original relationship and suggesting that, in fact, you look at multilateral determinations and negotiations subject to appropriate oversight, determining all those elements. So essentially what we would see that's required overall is that there's a fair process to determine prices set outside of the bilateral contract. You still have bilateral contracting, you still have medical teams directly contracting with players, but you need a way of determining those prices which are not bilaterally negotiated, which could potentially be unilaterally determined by the medical scheme as their reimbursement price, or by the service provider as the price they charge members. And that fair process, the problem that we have at the moment is that some people benefit from an unfair process at the moment. They don't mind the process remaining unfair. So in fact, they face potential disadvantage from a fair process. But a process that is fair, that is properly designed, should actually resolve many of the structural problems in price determination. So you need fair processes to set prices where there's significant market imbalances, and you need to protect the system of prescribed minimum benefits. If a price system unravels, we can't actually maintain the PMB framework, the prescribed minimum benefit framework, because essentially the prescribed minimum benefits get monopoly priced out of the system. And there needs to be a solution to deal with the structural market imbalances in the case of hospital services, and we've only touched on the absolute tip of the iceberg of the issues around private hospital services. So I'll finish there.
Thank you, Alex. The last presenter is going to be Wachowski, AstraZeneca, he's going to take us through a few areas that talk to risk and how the medical aid scheme operates in as far as mitigating or dealing and managing risk, and the risk equalization fund that we referred to earlier on. The REF has been funded, as has been mentioned by the Department of Health up until now. We think that MedHelp can now be rested in terms of its financing, as we'll be financing it through the levies that we receive from the members of the public and beneficiaries of the Medicare schemes in particular. Over to you, Basha.
Thank you very much, Elisha. Honorable Chairperson, honorable member, thank you for the opportunity. I've got a few slides. Thank you. I think I just wanted to show the slide to show what has happened to medical scheme membership. If you can see, 1990, there were about 4 million members, 1980, 4 million people belonging to medical schemes, which has grown to, we've known in 2009, there were about 7 or about 8 million members of the people belonging to medical schemes. Over this period, in the 80s, 90s, there were a very small proportion of these membership were African. The bulk were white, with some colours, and Indians, according to older former classifications. This picture has changed quite significantly over the period, and you now have the slide of the go up to 2009, but there's considerably more people. I think it's not going to be long before this profile actually reflects our society's profile as well. I think there's clear progress, which is visible in that slide. Next slide, please. But what we still have is we don't have a risk equalization system. So we still have very unfair discrimination against older and sicker people belonging to medical schemes. And it actually, the current system puts around 600,000 people's membership in jeopardy, and those are very vulnerable people. Those are sicker and older members that whose membership are vulnerable. Next slide, please, Alex. This slide just shows we've measured the risk using the risk equalization techniques, and we then classify schemes or scheme options, and we put them in different risk groups. Those medium risk groups on the middle, they're about 2.5, almost 3 million people are in there. They're in the medium risk groups. Of concern are these people in the very high and extremely high risk group medical scheme, around 600,000 people. And then there are a large number, just over 3 million people, well, 4 million people, 3.5 million people there that are in low risk people. So we have the situation where there's a group of people that are very vulnerable and they're in old and sicker groups. Next slide, please, Alex. And we need a system of risk equalization because if you look at the age and the health status of people, that really strongly correlates with the cost of that medical scheme, the financial risk. Those drive the cost of these schemes. And the age structures between schemes differ dramatically, and it could be either through design, by trying to attract young and healthy people to come and join your medical scheme, you add benefits, extra benefits that are attractive to young and healthy people at the expense of sicker and older people of society that then cannot belong there. But if you introduce a system of risk equalization, everyone then would actually face the same cost in respect of those prescribed minimum benefits, or that minimum benefit package. Currently, there's huge discrepancy. If you belong to a high-risk scheme, you pay much more money for that benefit than you do if you belong to a low-risk scheme. And there's an unfairness in that because it relates to your health status and your age. Can you have the next slide, please? What this does is it shows, if we look at all medical schemes, that is the industry average, is in that line. And these are lines representing each of the 105 medical schemes. You find there are quite a large number of relatively small schemes that are very high risk, and where on average, the cost for this benefit package, the minimum benefit package, is about 300 rand per beneficiary per month. in these very high risk schemes, the cost goes up to 300 rand on top of that. So it goes as high as 600 rand. And that purely depends on the age structure of that scheme, which determines that. And then there are a large number of schemes that are low risk, but these are generally much bigger schemes. So you find, can we have the next slide, please, Alex? We answered in the industry average is around 300 rand per beneficiary per month to get access to the prescribed minimum benefits. Your high risk people pay about 500 rand, and your low risk pay about 250 rand. Next slide, please. So, what many countries have done is to introduce systems of risk equalization. And this is a tried and tested method. And it comes in many guises, but it's employed in many countries throughout the world. We're not unique in thinking this way. It's a tried and tested method. Next slide, please, Alex. We have done continued a lot of work on the REF. We started with the Department of Health and the Council for Medical Schemes. We started a consultative process in 2003. We had many, many involvement, many discussion documents, many workshops, very transparent process. We submitted our work to an international review panel that contained eminent health insurance specialists from across the world. We recommended that we actually proceed with implementation. The minister in 2005 instructed the Council for Medical Schemes to prepare the office for a system of risk equalization. Cabinet then instructed the Department of Health to prepare the legislation to implement such a system in 2005. This bill was prepared and submitted to Parliament, but it was not considered by Parliament in 2007. Next slide, please. To implement such a risk system, one actually needs to have a goal, and then you need about a year to get all the systems in place, get the schemes data ready, and then get final evaluation of the impact after about a year after you've started, and then in the second year you can actually do the first financial transfers. The purpose of a system would be, such that you would take money from the low-risk schemes and use that money to cross-subsidize the sicker and older member in the older schemes. Because currently, there is not solidarity among schemes. Each scheme is on its own. And if you're young and healthy in this scheme, you don't cross-subsidize your grandmother and your grandfather who's in the sick old scheme. And that's a very unfairness. The social solidarity required to address this unfairness is absent in the fragmented system that we have. But having a risk equalization system, which we've tested and tried, addresses that societal concern. Next slide, please. Thank you. So, the continued delay in the implementation of such a system harms the industry. There are continued risk rating. If you're older and sicker, you belong to that scheme, you pay more than the other people in the younger and healthy scheme. And it affects vulnerable parts of society, both people with chronic diseases, with cancer, older and sicker people, the elder people that are facing it. And this continues while similar problems have been addressed internationally through such risk equalization systems. We've had a shadow system in place for 5 years that we've been collecting data from schemes. Every quarter we get their data, we measure their risk, we say to them, if the system were in place, that is how much money you would be paying into the risk equalization fund, or that is how much money you would be receiving from the fund. We've been doing this for 5 years. And it really is a low-cost intervention compared to other interventions to address this major systemic concern that we've seen in the industry. Thank you. I think that is my point. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thank you very much, Dr. Steneka, Chairperson, honorable members. We are reaching the last part of our presentation, just 2 slides, and thanks for outlining in particular the issue of the most vulnerable members of our society and us as the Council for Medical Schemes addressing that, the sick and the old. As well as the young and the healthy. We've got a system
that would work in any kind of healthcare system in South Africa. It is cheap, it can be implemented anytime. When its duty has been done and finished, it can be left, it can be dumped at that point in time. I'm addressing this chairperson precisely to allay the fears that some of the projects like this one might not fit in any new healthcare system that might come into the country. We are ready to deal with that as a council for medical team. We will fit in as a council in terms of the skills base that we have in any kind of a system moving forward as a country. I just wanted to make that point very clear. We then have, to that extent, in terms of our interaction with the ministry and the Department of Health, a meeting with the minister on a regular basis, because it is our statutory duty to do so. We do that when we discuss and update the Department of Health and the minister on issues of governance and compliance by these medical aid schemes. We pick up and we supervise and monitor them in terms of how do they comply with the Act, and the Act is the Medical Schemes Act. Secondly, as we do so, in the interest of the beneficiaries, we have identified quite a number of important things, including the demarcation process, which is a demarcation between what medical schemes have to do and what the other health insurance products out there are doing. We have support from the Minister of Health, and I'm sure the Minister has in the briefing to them updated you on this. There would have to be a process that involves the Treasury, that is Department of Finance, and we then ask your indulgence in debating this at some stage in the deliberations, health insurance products, as you find, because we find them to be based on risk rating instead of community rating. Our duty is to emphasize and promote community rating. They, that is the health insurance companies, deal and emphasize on risk rating. Regulation of brokers to address perverse relationships and conflict interests is a matter that is important. As you know, if we had time, we'll show you that there is little value added by some, if not most, of the health brokers that we have. The number and the expenditure on them is increasing, whilst in fact the number of people belonging to medical aid schemes has not increased significantly over the past 10 years. We have shown you that the 7 million people covered by the medical aid schemes has been relatively stable at that level, increasing up in recent times to 8.1 million people over the past 10 years, and yet the cost that are attracted by the healthcare programs has increased. It's an important point to make in addition to the slide that was shown to you, Chairperson and honourable members, when it comes to the private healthcare private hospitals. We have made recommendations, and we have made these recommendations to amend the PMB regulation, and these were submitted to the Minister in March this year. That process led to the establishment of the Code of Conduct together with the industry, and I'm happy to report to the honourable members that the Code of Conduct has now been developed, been established with the consent of all the stakeholders involved on the 31st of July, being operational on the 1st of August to deal with the issues of the PMB. We do emphasize that the actual act of the Regulation 8 specifically, that talks to the PMB is in place, it is in law, it has not been changed, and we will continue to enforce it, but in the context of what comes out in the deliberations and discussions we had on the Code of Conduct. That concludes my presentation, and I just want to mention that the industry, for the purposes of the members, the industry is stable, it is sound as it is. It will continue to do so. We want to ensure continued protection of the public. Once we deal with urgent interventions, whenever we are required to do that, we intend to emphasize and increase on the improvement on compliance through the training and enforcement of the Board of Trustees of these medical aid schemes. Because that is, those are the people who run the business of the medical aid scheme. They've got to be skilled, they've got to comply with the Act, and it is our duty to make sure that happens. We want to protect the PMB framework, as I referred earlier on, it's one of the pillars of the Council for Medical Schemes. intervention in price negotiations with death, with death, we've got a plan in place, we're selling it to the stakeholders, that is healthcare funders and providers, precisely to negotiate the issue of the price, especially that the RPL reference price list is now off the table. We intend and we want to be encouraged and assisted in implementation of the REF, which is the Risk Equalization Fund. That way we'll be able to strengthen the regulation on governance for the and compliance by brokers, managed healthcare organizations, and medical schemes. With that, I want to conclude and thank you for paying attention and giving us and affording us an opportunity to address you and update you on the work that we do. And I am privileged to together with the chairperson of council, member of council, and the senior staff members that we have. Thank you, Chair.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Thank you, Prospeak, and your counterpart for bringing Dr. Kanta. Thank you very much. We have listened to Table 4, Dan, Alex, and Dr. Steenkamp. Am I right? Yeah, okay. There seems to be members who are going to be asking questions. But we've always been confronted with this cost of health that are going up every day. And we seem to think that we are the right group to talk to and find out, is there something? But one is not sure whether this RPL, as it was presented by Alex, whether does it have enough teeth to bite, or is just there to... obviously would be very much interested. And there seems to be something that you alluded to, Dr. Sengab, about this risk equalization and the bill that was supposed to be amended, and apparently nothing has happened. And we would be very interested as the members of parliament in looking into that, because it seems as if what this is trying to do is trying to make sure that all of us, be it I'm sick or for some disadvantages, but I must get the same benefits as the one who got a lot of money. You know, there's another important point about this health insurance, which Redefine mentioned to Dr. Kanto, where you always find, they're always advertised that get this and that, and it's interesting that they don't belong to you. You can't look after them. Somebody else will go to look after them. And obviously one would want to know, how can we do it such that they report to one person? If it has to do with health, it has to be with health, and we've got to consider it. And I see, obviously, the specialists, I think one day many members would need to call the health specialist to talk to one day. I don't know how we would call them, because they are not paid by government. But we'll have to find a way of calling them, because this is the hospitals and the health specialists are the ones who are taking the big chunk of money. That is it. Maybe I shouldn't have come here, I should have remained a specialist and make more money. There's an area of complementary medicine. I saw that it's the hospital, it's the specialist, and there's a big gap in that slide you showed. The amount, we find that the complementary health and allied health, whatever, are taking a lot of money. That is the slide. The supplementary and allied health professionals are taking a big chunk of money. And I'm not sure, are these groups regulated, or they're not regulated, they're just doing their own thing? But this is, can I request that, you know what we did? Was to organize tea for the dean and tea for the council for medical schemes. And the tea for you is ready. So I thought that maybe before the members ask questions, unless there's a burning question, then we'll go for tea. That's 5 minutes so that we can have that tea and then come back. We really wanted to talk on our behalf in lowering the health costs that are really hampering us. I don't know how do we talk to the private hospitals and the specialists, but we'll find a way of talking to them. So can we have tea for 5 minutes and then come back? And then we'll be asking questions. Okay. It's great, the tea was organized for you.
Thank you.
No, don't run away. You can come closer.
No, don't come closer. You see it very fine.
I thought you were coming closer again. She doesn't have a I just want to love all of us.
And then we'll discuss the table for how much.
Oh, he's handling finances.
No, then he's got a lot of money.
There is the man who's handling finances of the chairman. He wants him. Now you're going to decide how much money.
Yeah, I know, very excellent. They've got the whole family.
You know, the nurse I hear has been sick and she was hospitalized. And she says she joined the committee because she's a patient. And she wants to understand how medical is the type of environment and so on. That's why she's in this committee. Okay, members, it's up to you to ask questions that you want to ask. But I was just stressing some of the things that I thought that were important, especially those that talk about these health insurances that we might be either belong to health or to finance, treasury, and the bills that probably we need to look into so that we can make sure that what the council wants to do can be achieved. Because there seems to be a deal that was stopped somewhere, and we really need to know at length as to those. So those are some of the things that they'll need to tell us more. Okay, members. I see Umaltuli, I see Umatule, I see Mike. So we'll go that you can start. Oh, okay, Mike. We can start now. We've got an hour to go.
Yeah.
Yes, Maltuli.
Thank you for the presentation. For me, I must just say that, you know, I'm happy to see that things have moved quite a bit from what they were in 1994 with the, you know, medical aid schemes. I'm also doing private practice, and my God, it was something else. So it is to be really commended. It's been a lot. You know, but we've moved really to put some sense and direction in this whole area of medical aid costs and all that. But now, my question with the presentation is, I was trying to follow on when you're dealing with, you know, the money goes here, there, training and so on, salaries. And I couldn't just see, perhaps in simple, you know, just straightforward way, what percentage of the total budget, you know, goes to salaries? What, you know, of the total amount, how much goes to salaries in terms of percentage? Because it's easier, I think, for us to understand that. And then the other one is the issue of the, you know, on brokers. Yeah. On the matter of brokers. I think this matter of brokers has been there, you know, for quite some time. And we perceive them as added burden, you know, on the customers and on the brokers, really. And I think that now it needs to come to an end somehow. It should just come to an end because there is no reason why it should be protracted. It's to the benefit of people who could find other jobs. It is really the poor. You know, it should not be there anymore. I'm talking because I was in the Portfolio Committee of Health some time back, up to 2004, something like that. And we're talking about it. And it is still issue. Thank you.
Thanks, ma'am. The next one was Uma Dube, then Uma Kenya and Uma.
Yeah, thanks, Professor, and thanks for the presentation. I'm happy that that came after I was discussed from the hospital. There are certain things that I want to find out as a patient, not as an academic. That when you say you are protecting people, are you protecting us as members who have medical aid schemes? Or maybe you are protecting their medical aid schemes? Because if you are protecting us, how do you protect us as members? Another question is, I want to check, how do you monitor all the medical schemes that belong or that are registered under you? The reason why I'm asking is that there are so many things happening. The control of charging, whatever, whether it's admin fee, medicine that you get, how do you control that and how do you check it? Another question is, why are members not allowed to have extended family if they are above 80 or 21, or those who are not working in particular, they can be my kids, they can be my brothers or whoever, because some medical schemes does not allow them. I have to say you are missing property. Is it better to live or to rent? But also when you are missing, my experience is that people who are missing have got problems in maintenance. Are you maintaining the buildings or the person you are missing from is maintaining? And how does it happen? Is it popular? Are you satisfied? Can you come and find the place not missing? The lady from the pharmacist, I don't know if you will be able to answer that question. Lady from pharmacist, you get a script from the clinic, hospital, doctor. When you go to a pharmacy, they will charge you a lady. That in fact are not also the same. I also, my script, I usually take them to this pharmacy because at least the rent is not that high, the lady. So how do you claim? Can we claim that lady from the medical team, or is it my excuse me, my that I'm not copying my is it my responsibility to pay the lady? And if it's there, can it be controlled if maybe you have access to that? What else do I have?
No, you can leave it, Chris.
Yeah, for the next round.
For the next round.
Oh, okay.
But you must understand, Chris, there are two things that usually make a cough, besides the infection. It's when you move from a warm area to a cold area, hitting you with cough in anybody. The other one is talking too much. Okay, Maka, you.
Sorry, what we are doing, if you could dot down all of these things, then you just can answer.
Thank you, and thank you, all of you, for the explanation. Yeah, that's clear and pretty clear. My question, Chris, just answered all my questions on the issue of the land, but I want to add more on that. So why is the price of the over-counter medicine fluctuating? The daily. It's fluctuating. To make an example, I am from Eastern Cape. I know the level I pay when I buy medicine there. But to my surprise, when I went to Pretoria in the pharmacy, there was a different case. I had to pay more, almost 98% of the medicine. And I said to them, what is the aim of taking we want us to give your card. I didn't use the card if I had to pay 102 on the counter when I buy the medicine for 120 grand. That's almost 100% of the payment. So there's no need there to produce your card. Yeah, that's my first question. My second question is for acceptance of code of conduct. For whom is this established? Thirdly, where is normal present and get on the issue of salaries? But now I'm not as a new member in Parliament. I don't know where does the salaries come from. Do they come from the Department of Health budget? And lastly, all the problems with my print age. It is said that damage has been done on the RPL, on the foreign publication of the RPL.
Without the mechanics therefore, and they to rectify that damage. Thank you. Thank you, Mike. I must say, Mike, I must say, the Med Council of Medical Aid Scheme was put up to make sure that they regulate the Medicare Aid. Because they were going haywire. And basically that's why that's the way that the Sabbath is doing over and above the other things, but to regulate that. And that, well, the most of the questions that have come are still on that, because even this rising cost, because we're very worried about this rising cost and paying differently here and there. And it's the medical aid that are doing that. Now we want to know, are you regulating that? Are you on top of issues, or is there something that needs to be done to make you to be able to control this? Not that we say the cost must not go high, but the way they're going up is too much. Mike?
Thank you, Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I just want to ask a few questions. The first one pertains to the expanding of membership of the medical scheme. Whether or not the council has any ideas on how we can ensure that all working families have medical cover to some degree. And with that, how great would the Risk Equalisation Fund play in this, in ensuring that semi-skilled families can afford medical cover? And how restricted is the prescribed minimum benefit in ensuring that all families can obtain medical cover? If you can just answer that, doesn't make any sense, but because the prescribed minimum benefit, the PMDs, I mean, for someone like me who has medical cover, it's great, you know, you get, well, you know, and that's how it should be. I mean, you're paying for a particular package of services. But it also makes the threshold so high that it excludes a lot of people who are actually working. And so how do we get that balance? And then as far as the costs are concerned, I mean, yes, I agree. We want to keep costs down, and I'm not making any excuses for anybody. But if you look at medical costs per se, private and public, they are spiraling out of control. And hence, the nine provincial departments of health, I mean, they're 12 billion rand in the red. And that just gives an indication of how underfunded the public sector is and how we sort of just jointing the budget to the actual cost every year. But having said that, and this is just a comment, I mean, you said that there's high increases in hospitals and medical specialists, but then you also talk about, just, you know, 11% increase in your salaries yourself, as well as 18% increase in levy. So even though while I appreciate what you've got to keep the cost down in the private sector, the fact is you also are not immune to the spiraling cost of healthcare. And as the financial person, I forgot his name, said, is that, you know, the cost of employing actuaries and accountants is very expensive. And I'm sure this is part of the cost for the public and the private sector as well. But you also mentioned that you have taken over the funds for the risk equalization. While we don't have it, as we've heard, can you just unpack that? Because I don't understand what you mean by you've taken over the risk equalization fund. Is it the survey you're doing every year that you've been doing for the past 5 years, or is it something else? If you unpack that, I would appreciate it. Thank you, Chet.
Thank you. The financial goal is Dan, Mike. They are guys, you must understand, Register, that the person who was talking, her mother is in hospital now. So I'm not sure whether her mother is covered by his medical aid. It seems that this is she's not covered.
But
she's on discovery. Okay. Is there any other thing before, or monthly at the last hour?
Yeah.
You want to come back again?
Can I just
you're repeating now, both
yes.
of you. why don't we give him then to answer, and then you can come back, both of you.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson and the honourable member of the committee.
By the way, before you start, you feel free at the end of answering some of the questions as to some of the things that you think the committee can help the organization in moving forward.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, we're doing oversight, but at the same time, we've got some power to do certain things. If you feel there's certain things that you want to highlight to us that can help the organization to move forward, feel free to mention them.
Thank you. thank you very much, Chairperson. The the questions, I've been quoting the questions as they come up, and I'm going to allocate a delegation to deal with a few. I'm going to ask Mr. Craig Barton-Durham, who is the head of the legal services, to deal with the questions that will be relating to the DL amendment one, the issue of the protection of the whom are we protecting and why, in terms of the legislation and the act, and the issue of the extended family, if you can just deal with that. And then I'm going to ask Alex to deal with the question that dealt with the brokers, demarcation, those two first. Can we start with you, Kate?
Thank you, Honourable Chairperson and Honourable Members. If I could possibly then start with the first question, which I think went to the issue of the protection of members and who we protect, whether or not it's medical schemes per se or whether it's in fact the members. If I could just revert to the, you recall the slide which the Registrar presented on in terms of Section 7, where in fact central to the role and function which we perform as a Council for Medical Schemes is really the protection of members and the protection of beneficiaries. In other words, we regulate at all times in the public interest. So the centre of the diagram, if you like, in terms of how we function, is the member of the medical scheme. Obviously, members belong to medical schemes. Medical schemes are not companies in the ordinary sense of the word. They're mutual societies. They're funds to which people contribute. And each and every person who contributes to a medical scheme has part ownership of that particular medical scheme. So the Board of Trustees who govern that scheme govern it at all times in the interest of those members. So the members and the member and the interest of that member always remain very much at the forefront of how a medical scheme is required to be run. And in terms of the provisions of corporate governance, and I think quite a bit has been said this morning about that, and precisely how we ensure that the provisions of good governance are enforced in medical schemes at all times, the member always remains central to that. In terms of us enhancing that protection and looking towards how we further ensure that members, as individuals in these schemes, are protected, we look at things like the prescribed minimum benefits, the extent to which members are able to obtain access to those benefits to which they are entitled in terms of their membership of medical schemes. And I think we've seen, related to that, some of the suggestions that have been made and some of the indications that have been given this morning in terms of us seeking to enhance the tool which we use to ensure that protection. And that tool is the Medical Schemes Act. And in so doing, we are obviously required to ensure that the tool remains sharp at all times. And that's really where legislative reform and legislative amendment, I think, plays a very, very central role. Honourable Members, you've been informed this morning about the draft bill that was up at some point, had been drafted, and the steps that we've taken to enhance the legislation. So I think all of these matters are actually interrelated in terms of how we regulate. But to come back to the answering of the question, it is the interest of members at all times that are central to the way in which we regulate medical schemes. I'm happy to take any points of clarification when I'm done. In terms of the extended family, the question around who is protected, what is the line of protection, is obviously the principal member, who's the person who belongs to the medical scheme, and his or her dependents, which are of course defined, and those would ordinarily be, in terms of your immediate family, are the people who are entitled to belong to a medical scheme in terms of dependency. Dependency is not entirely an age-related matter. We all know that one has children at school, and very often students who are dependent upon their parents, and to the extent that any principal member is able to demonstrate that a person whom they bear responsibility in terms of that relationship is dependent upon them, they are entitled to have those particular people on the medical scheme as their dependents. Thank you.
No, I just want to make a comment there, Governor. You're still having you can still coordinate your team, your choir. But this was formulated because there were problems in medical aid schemes. They were running haywire, and there was nobody was regulating them. And then there's CMF came to regulate, which was a very good thing. But the question that I want to ask, but you don't have to answer it now, or we can answer it some other time, is that obviously there were problems why it was set up. Now, did we say when we have the CMS, at least they're not going to go back and charge them for those things that they did that made us to do this? And instead, we'll have, before we get into law, but we'll try and negotiate. Because you only go to law when negotiations are faced. Do we have a window of doing that, of negotiations, before you actually say, we're going to charge this person, we're going to do this? Because I always believe we need to talk before we go to law. It's only that I'm very much afraid of lawyers, and I'm afraid of judges and everything else. So I would like to negotiate. But you don't have to answer it now. But I think you are the right person, Craig, to, after this meeting, even if it's me and a few other members, where we can meet and talk about this bill and these other things that have not happened, including this treasury one. It keeps on haunting me, this thing of treasury. In fact, the person I don't have to, the one that you usually see is clientele, where they say you pay when you go to the hospital, you pay this. And you find that this regulator cannot talk to them because they belong to treasury. Yet people are getting there and they're having problems. And when you have problems, you don't know who to go to because this one belongs to treasury and the others belong to health. I think maybe we need to talk about that later on. You are still finishing up. You're still coordinating his choir.
I'm going to ask Alex, and then after Alex, Dan. Alex will deal with the issue of the brokers, the demarcation, and pharmacies, and touch on the PMDs. Dan must deal with the issue of the lease of the property, and the question relating to this of the property and the salary bill and an increase in level.
Yeah, the first is on the demarcation issue between the health insurance product. One of the things that was very problematic in the sort of pre-1998 period was that, in fact, the medical schemes environment had been deregulated by the previous government in 1994. And essentially what they did was it allowed free reign for people to risk rate people and exclude people dramatically on the basis of health status. And it took a while to get a new regulatory regime in place. So it took really up till 2000 with everything through to kind of get it right. And one of the key issues was actually dealing with products, really defining the business of a medical scheme. The problem that has really hit the Medical Schemes Act was a very sort of problematic interpretation of the business of a medical scheme by the Supreme Court. And this really requires, although there's still a degree of clarity, we do require legislative amendments to clarify the provision so that we have an absolutely clear framework. But a further problematic element is that, in fact, an exemption framework has been introduced to the Medical Schemes Act in the Long and Short-Term Insurance Bill, which are quite problematic in creating coherence in national policy, given that National Treasury is in fact has no authority over health policy. So these are issues that really from a legislative perspective have to be fixed up, and I think that's an area we come back on. On the issue of brokers, the structural problem that exists is the distinction between advice and marketing. And if a scheme is essentially providing, if the scheme is remunerating a broker to give you advice on whether or which scheme to buy, there is an automatic conflict of interest. So the regulatory restructuring that's required is primarily separating out advice from marketing and also separating out how people are remunerated in relation to that. And that is a very key area. And it also, furthermore, a requirement that people have a choice. If you do not want to have advice, then you don't have to pay for it. So those are key issues which we want to address from a legislative perspective as well going forward. And it's those structural issues, and they will correct a lot of the damage that we're seeing now in terms of poor advice and overexpenditure. On the issue of the pharmacy levy, part of that, I sit on the pricing committee as a ministerial appointment, but I'm a speak on their behalf, but the issue actually falls under the jurisdiction of the Medicines and Related Substances Control Act, and the whole issue has been left unclear because of the failure to get a coherent sentence in place for a period, because of the court actions and a lot of those disputes. And what's happened is that people have essentially had free rein to charge additional pharmacy admin fees, or essentially pharmacy dispensing fees, outside of what the medical scheme is prepared to reimburse. So you have a mismatch between what the scheme is prepared to pay and what the pharmacist is charging. And essentially that environment should be cleared up with the publication and final implementation of the dispensing fees. On the issue of the, an issue was just raised on the RPL process, what was wrong with it, the damage that's been done, that particular comment. The damage that's referring to is really that people have sat together in the same room. It deals with the competition issue. When somebody behaves in an anti-competitive manner, and I'm not talking about conduct in this instance, the problem with the structure of the RPL discussion, in that I've sort of framed about eight issues that require separate determinations potentially to have a complete pricing framework, and RPL is only one of them. And the problem is that the moment you put people in a room and they discuss the structure of price and the final price, you can't stop there without completing the rest of the picture. So the problem is you're kind of permitting collusion to occur, but you're not actually completing the whole picture so that you can relate what's happening in the RPL process to affordability, the budget constraints in medical schemes and in private households. So really what we're suggesting is that you can't just have a quarter of a process, you must have a complete process. And RPL is just one element of a nine-component process, and therefore a regime needs to be created for the full framework. On the issue, just to respond to the issue of expanding membership, just respond to that, and in relation to the PMB issue. There is a trade-off in that if you have, if you expand prescribed minimum benefits, you're protecting members from schemes selectively excluding certain benefits. And even with the current PMB framework we have in place, it's a full-time job trying to deal with medical schemes who are sneaking benefits out of people. They only find out medical scheme rules are very complicated. They don't always realize what their entitlements are when they take up a medical scheme. And in fact, they can't entirely be blamed for not knowing. And so we try from a regulatory perspective to have requirements that are in there that mean that from an intervention at the regulatory perspective and from the sort of from regulation prevents them from having to know that in many respects, so that we protect it. And we've got our gaps in that system. But the more complete you make that, the higher the cost of the minimum benefit framework that you have in place. And that can exclude people who have an affordability constraint in joining. One of the major solution areas is, in fact, to restructure things like the subsidy framework, the tax subsidies that are in place. And, in fact, proposals have been put in the last two budget proposals by National Treasury on introducing a tax credit framework to, in fact, expand, to change the subsidy framework so people at that level can actually, it becomes affordable to join schemes for that minimum level of cover. I think that.
Thank you, Chair. There were questions around the salary bill and what is the percentage of the salary bill to the total budget. The salary bill accounts for about 64% of our total budget. We've indicated that we are attracting very highly skilled personnel from accountants, from actuaries, lawyers, and doctors, etc. You'll appreciate that we are regulating an 84 billion industry, and therefore we need quite competent people in order to deal with that particular area. Because in their respective area as well, schemes do employ such competent skills as well. They do have accountants, they do have actuaries, and if they submit financial statements to us, they must match, they must feel the same confidence in that regard. So we are attracting highly skilled personnel in that regard. The salary bill totally did increase by about 11%, but the actual increase individual was about 8%. And we pointed out the 11%
It's a contract for by because we'll be employing extra people, and we've given a general inflationary increase as is the norm every in our organization. As a result of that, and with other budget issues, the levy increased by about 287 rand per member per year, from 15.52 cents to about 18.29 cents. It's 11% increase in percentage, but if you look at it in rent terms, it's only 287 cents per member per annum, which is, in our view, a very nominal increase in that regard. The issue of the lease of the building that we occupy as opposed to buying and the maintenance thereof. The PFMA directed to account for the leasing either as a finance lease or an operating lease. And the finance lease is quite costly, as you are aware. And if we were to go the finance lease route, we have to also finance the cost of that lease, which is the financing cost, which is the interest on the amount of money shall be borrowed. And because we are constrained in terms of our budget, we've opted for the operating lease, which is much cheaper and is also within our budget. Because if you go the financing route, we must go and borrow money, buy the building, finance that cost of the lease, finance the capital and the repayment. And the effect is that we are going to increase the levy substantially because we are not funded by any other grant. We are wholly funded by the levies from schemes. As it was a question from an honorable member, the salaries are paid like any other cost from the funding of the levies. We are not getting any grant from the department. So that is why we opted for the rental of the building that we are occupying. In terms of the maintenance of the landlord do undertake the maintenance of the building. The structural maintenance has been done. The air conditioning and all of this is part of our lease agreement. It is the landlord's responsibility. What we are responsible for example, is the normal cleaning of our building, which also we've also contracted our cleaning services. The maintenance of our abolition facilities, all those things. So that is on our cost. But the general maintenance of the building is a rental one in terms of the lease agreement. Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure. I'm sure I've covered all the technical questions related to finance.
Let's hope you're not listening from a medical expert.
No. Very clear. That could be a conflict of interest.
Oh,
we're very clear.
I just wanted to add, Chairperson and the Honourable Member, to the question that Honourable Mike asked, that when it comes to the salary structure and the salary deal, there are four levels of approval that need to be done before even that salary bill is approved. The Council needs to interrogate the salary bill proposals made to them, then they approve it. The Department of Health needs to give an approval in the process, the Minister of Health and the Minister of Finance. Those are all the levels that no changes in that salary structure would have to take place without the approval in terms of the PFMA should be done without those four levels of approval. I just wanted to emphasize that.
If you are to tell you, what do you feel this one?
The shop is going to deal with the second set of questions. Yes, over to you.
Thank you, Jefferson. The Registrar of the Office to respond to the questions on race, DMV regulations, and the code of conduct, and which came out. And I thought we started in 2008 to go through an extensive public consultation process to review the existing prescribed minimum benefits as they are. Those benefits, the Minister says, must be paid in full by a medical scheme, and that is prescribed in terms of the Act. So we've gone through an extensive process, and then I'd like to answer some of the questions in that we considered the opinion of hundreds of submissions We've established 13 clinical advisory committees that consisted of professors and academics and doctors and medical schemes and members of the public, including patient groups, that came to talk about what benefits they need on this prescribed minimum benefit package. We considered all of that, and we costed it. We then developed a complete economic model to see what would happen if the full package was put on. We would actually see we would lose members because everyone cannot afford it. So it becomes a very difficult choice. It's saying we can have more members, they have full package, so you can afford it. You can afford this car because it's cheap, but you get in there and you find there's no seats and there's not an engine. So the balance is to find a car that you can use, and that is where we tap for the existing set of minimum benefits. But it is expensive, as you're saying. Our estimate is around R300 per beneficiary per month. So that was fully considered. That then resulted in a set of PMB regulations, which was developed by the Department of Health and the officials on the PMB steering committee, considering the inputs from the public, which were then developed and submitted to council. Professor Pick has then submitted as chairperson of council the set of recommendations to the minister in March. To try and get more pertinent answers to your questions, when you spoke about how REF would be involved in explaining the access, REF deals to equalize the unfairness currently had in terms of risk profile, your age and your health status risk. That is what Harris can address. Alex has referred to Treasury's willingness to assist with tax credits that would actually assist in a different element. The one element is how do you equalize in terms of your risk, your health status, so that healthy and sick people pay the same. The other issue is in terms of income, and that is where Treasury comes in, where Alex spoke about tax credits, which has been referred to. Finally, we submitted these regulations in March, and then it became apparent there are a lot of problems in the PMBs, and those regulations are not yet in force. So we established a task team consisting of medical scheme members, members, the patient groups, doctors, the providers, the hospitals, and the schemes, and we set up such a multilateral task team. We interrogated the problems that currently exist in people having to make co-payments for PMBs or not being, the services not being paid for in full, and we basically developed a set of conduct around that, and we defined how it must be paid in full, what it must be paid in full, what is the exact benefit, and all that detail, every detail is defined in detail in our code of conduct document. We also emphasized the need of proper communication between medical schemes and their members, so that members don't go to hospital thinking they can get a private room and then end up having to make co-payments for the private room while they couldn't qualify for private room in accordance with their benefits. So those are to improve the transparency and the certainty of members knowing where they go and what they get, and improving schemes' ability to understand their own liability in this respect. I think that is what the purpose of the Code of Conduct was, so that Trump could then get a gentleman's agreement to say, this is how we will interpret these laws, and this is what we will do until such stage as these revised PMB regulations are in place. Thank you, Chair.
Are you done now? Okay,
this is the second one. We're left with about 20 minutes to finish. Okay. Mantulo came first, and then it's going to be you. You drop your hand, man.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, let's start with Mantulo.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I think, I don't know the name, sorry.
The name is
Craig. I think he talked to the you know, the dependent. Now, I don't quite understand. You know, I can talk about personal experience. Now, where you are a member, principal member, and then your child develops an illness and become handicapped by that illness to the extent of unable to you know, to work at all. And then this child is over 18 years, and therefore this child cannot be included. You know, you apply that as the child and you're the clinical person. You want the child to go under medical aid and you under your as a dependent. Now, what is the issue there? Because it ends up meaning that the member pays for yourself, and at the same time, there's a dependent who is over 18 years old, but in fact is a complete dependent, and you have to pay for that. That person, you've got to pay for them separately, and in a kind of like private or whatever, like public way. Can you explain that to me, please? How it is that this cannot, such a person cannot be considered a dependent?
Okay, we can switch off now. I'm sure Craig will be able to answer, but I just have to slightly caution ourselves. We are dealing with the regulator here. We're not dealing with the specific medical aid. I'm trying to say, maybe some of the questions that we're asking should be targeting the specific medical aid, and then we go to the regulator when we find no joy in the medical aid that we're dealing with. Let me make an example. If I belong to PAMED, and PAMED refuses to take my child to 18 years old to who can't do anything for himself, then I negotiate with them and I try not to, then I come to the regulator to say what is it, but I'm not sure, but you'll answer okay. What I'm saying is that probably this should go to your medical aid. This should go to your medical aid directly, and if you don't find joy with the permit,
exactly.
No, he is a regulator. Craig is a regulator, he's not the PAMED medical aid. He regulates PAMED. And you should take it to PAMED directly and say, PAMED, why are you not taking my child? And if you don't find your, then you go to him.
Okay, I am saying that PAMED has given no job.
Now, you know, the next question that comes down my too is that there are so many people who belong to PAMED. Unfortunately, they are not members of Parliament. They don't have this opportunity of the opportunity that you have. But in any case, that's what I'm saying.
I'm asking on their behalf.
Okay.
Thank you. Thanks, Jefferson. My question will be directed to the Risk Equalization Fund. You said that the risk of equalization unfairly discriminates against older and sicker members of medical schemes and jeopardizes medical schemes to cover almost around 600,000 vulnerable beneficiaries. I want to find out what is it that we as lawmakers here can assist to empower the council so that we bring about fair medical cover to all groups. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think this is really what I was actually calling for. And in fact, this is why we should meet the legal team so that they can tell us how to craft whatever law that is going to be assisting them so that these things are not happening. And I think it's just a comment from Umema said, but stressing the part that we need to assist you in making sure that what needs to be done for the people is going to be done. Okay, Matthew.
Chapter 9, I don't know whether it's a question or a comment or an information. It relates to, I know we are dealing with cancer now. But if I go to hospital with my medical aid, I get admitted, But what I've observed is that there are shops out there that, you know, spark our medical aid whichever way they can. I'll give an example as to what happened to me last time when I was supposed to be admitted. I came walking on my 2 feet. I was supposed to be admitted because my blood pressure was too high and they discovered that I had sugar. It was also sugar. Now the doctor that wanted to admit me said I was supposed to be admitted in ICU. Now you can imagine to me how expensive will ICU be. And what was informing the doctor to say, I came walking, I'm still walking, to say I must be admitted in ICU. Because I'm a clever person, I refuse. And I didn't see the reason why, because I'll be laying next to a corpse in ICU. And I got more sick, and maybe my blood pressure will go higher than the way it was. Mm-hmm. So this is how some of them are, you know, injecting money out of our medical aid scheme, our medical aid fund, so that in future when we go to hospital, your money is exhausted. So I want to find out, are you aware of this and how can we control this so that it doesn't happen to a lot of us?
Thanks, Mr. And I suspect this is another one that probably you can answer it by saying, as a regulator, how do you empower the members to be able to understand what is going on? Because this is very true, that a doctor could have used a cheaper medicine or a cheaper way of treating you, but he decides to use a more expensive one because there's going to be money, more money, either to him or to her or to the institution that he's working for. So, and they're taking people for a ride. But probably it's not something that you need to answer directly because it's done by those particular people. But how do you empower us as members of medical aid to be able to know all those things? Okay, those were the questions. That I don't think I've left anybody out. Those were the questions. Maybe a registrar.
Thank you,
Shepard. Oh, there was a specific one to Craig, but I'm not sure whether you want to answer it, but
Thank you, Honourable Chair. In terms of the question posed by the Honourable Member, just to say that it's certainly a question that we welcome, and a very, very important question, I think, because it goes to the rights of members of medical schemes, something with which we are very, very concerned at the Council, and something which we pay very high regard to. Just to say, in terms of the legal position, if a person, in terms of dependency, as long as a person remains a dependent, in the particular case, the facts, I think that have been outlined here, the particular person, if they were to become incapacitated for whatever reason and would remain dependent on the principal member, then they would be a dependent and would be required to be treated as such. It's very important also, I believe, in this context, that medical schemes, and it's something that we do require of them, communicate very clearly the rules. Medical schemes function in terms of their rules, and the rules of the scheme should be very, very clear around issues such as this. So those are just a few, you know, opening remarks around the actual position that one's dealing with over here. And this particular instance, I think Honourable Chair, you pointed out, the first port of call would be the medical scheme in order to establish what the reason was for the person, the particular problem not being addressed. Medical schemes are required in terms of the Act to also have dispute resolution committees in place, and no medical schemes rules can be registered unless that provision does exist in the rules. So the member is entitled to declare a dispute with a medical scheme in terms of the rules, and that dispute must be properly adjudicated in terms of those provisions. If the member does not obtain joy in terms of that situation, then of course there is the Council. The Registrar earlier in his presentation made reference to the fact that we do have a complaints adjudication unit dedicated to actually assisting members and to adjudicating complaints of this nature. A member would be entitled then to approach the Council for Medical Schemes for Relief, to set out the facts of the particular case to us. In terms of the provision of Section 47 of the Medical Schemes Act, the particular complaint would then be referred to the scheme for their input and their views as to the position,
and after that has been done, and all the facts have been obtained, the council will then adjudicate on that matter. The adjudication is an adjudication deemed to be an adjudication of the registrar. The registrar's determination in resolving the particular issue, a ruling gets made, and that ruling is then referred to both parties. The scheme gets a copy, as does the member. And then there are various appeal processes that our legislation does provide for. But certainly we do invite members of medical schemes, when they are faced with this sort of situation, to really approach us as a council, because that's one of the core functions. It goes to the earlier question as to, do we protect members or do we protect medical schemes? We protect members. We don't always rule in favour of members, because sometimes the rules of the scheme may be such that in fact the scheme may be correct. But on the facts of this particular case, I would certainly submit that it seems to me that this person is a dependent and that would remain a dependent and should be treated as such by the medical school. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Chairperson, honourable member. On the question of the ICU admission or non-admission or out of to be treated as an outpatient, I think it's important for us also to remember that the medical doctors are being regulated and are regulated by HPCSA. Medical schemes and administrators are regulated by us as the council. In this case, you will find a situation where there is a very good clinical reason that would make a person walking in with his or her 2 feet, but on further investigation, you find there is a ticking time bomb that then requires that one should be admitted. Admitted in a ward or admitted in an ICU. That becomes a clinical decision. The assumption, obviously, is that the decision made by this attending physician is a sound ethical one and based on the clinical facts, and therefore it probably is in the best interest of the beneficiary to be admitted at that point in time. That's one part of the solution or an explanation to that. The second one is the fact that there's another third element here that is not covered, and that's the private hospital itself. There is no regulatory body for private hospitals at this point in time. There's always been, there are many suggestions that say that's a missing link. Private hospitals need to be regulated, and many suggestions have been made to make sure that they are regulated just like the rest of the other service providers and make sure that they work within the regulatory framework and the ethical standards. So that's a suggestion that probably the health portfolio committee needs to view and actually advance to a position, to a state where, like other service providers are regulated, they also need to be regulated. That would address the issues of the good standard operations procedure on their part in taking forward that you do not just get admitted in ICU and yet the reason is none other than clinical, but it is more of the commercial in nature. That will take care of that. I think, Chairperson, the other question has been addressed. There was a question earlier on the administration fees and how do we register, how are the medical aid schemes registered. We've got a fully fledged unit within the Office of the Registrar accrediting these various institutions or entities that are registered, where the administrators of the medical schemes need to be looked at, must submit proposals, they are examined to a point where they must be accredited as administrators. And therefore there is a fee that they would have to declare to the council as to how do they intend to do the business of the medical schemes according to the Act. There are figures in place, and if Ms. Mazia has got the figures at hand where she can share those with us regarding the supervision, the financial supervision of the administrators and the medical aid schemes. They submit this information to the council and whether those are within the Act and at what levels, so that we do not have medical aid schemes and administrators charging an administration fee that is out of line with what is required and what is expected of them. We do know, and we've got information to the effect that some medical schemes and administrators are charging administration fee, which is out of line with what needs to be charged. Some of them are too big, and yet also the administration fee is still too high. Whereas some medical schemes and administrators are small, and the administration fee is probably low or high. So that supervision of that financial aspect is in place, and we deal with that. Financial supervision, you need to look into that.
registration of the benefits, but Medicare extends to the benefits BMU, which is benefits monitoring management unit, would then have to look into them. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In the absence of any questions, in any case, our time is up now. So I think Alex is reminding you of something.
Yes, there's another question that has not been answered. We want to make a point that all the questions that have been asked are answered to the best of our ability. There was a question on the REF and discrimination against old and sick people, and how does the REF, how will it address that, and whether we've got examples of situations where some schemes are discriminating against others on the basis of age. That's a question that is important to be asked, and I'm asked Alex to deal with it.
Yeah, there are a number of measures. Obviously, the key measure is the, from a statutory perspective, is the Risk Equalisation Fund, which essentially makes a whole lot of independent funds operate as a single fund in relation to protection, so you don't have that variation. Secondly, it removes incentives that schemes have to just through the way that it operates. It actually changes the incentive structures on schemes, that they don't have to worry about excluding people because they have a worse health status, because they're going to be compensated for it through the Risk Equalisation Fund. So it neutralises that behaviour. The further issue is that, and basically that is a statutory regime that has to be introduced, because there are winners and losers, and you'll never have universal consent to introduce it. So that would be a matter brought here. The on the issue of demarcation, if you have a regulated insurance market side by side with an unregulated insurance market, the unregulated insurance market will trump the regulated insurance market always. So in those instances, the entire regulatory regime will be undermined by permitting a parallel insurance market to exist that doesn't have to comply with the same conditions. That's in effect part of what we're trying to deal with now on the demarcation matter, which does have to be completely resolved, otherwise one can't deal with that. Other measures only really become fully strengthened. We have open enrollment, which prevents schemes from rejecting people on the basis of their health status, and the prescribed minimum benefit framework itself is critical, because even if you have those other measures in place, you can still very selectively offer benefits so that those older and sicker people don't have benefits. So you only target the benefits of the young and healthy ones. But if you don't have a prescribed minimum benefit framework in place, then you also have an incomplete protection regime. So in essence, the requirement for the medical schemes environment involves a number of very specific statutory interventions to make the system work as a single pool, which is community rating, open enrollment, prescribed minimum benefits, and risk equalisation. And those in acting together with a strong framework will in fact protect access. I just want to make one comment on the issue of the hospitals, which is just to point out that one of the problems that does arise is that because we don't have a complete regulatory framework that deals with all providers, including the hospitals, we also have certain problems in that we have conflicts of interest between, for instance, doctors and hospitals. They can own shares. And if they have shares in hospitals, the question is, what are their incentives in relation to an admission? So the separation, removing conflicts of interest, and having that as an important part of the overall design becomes important. And the problem is, in the absence of a clear regulatory regime for those, we actually permit a whole lot of things. Nobody actually has the authority to directly deal with them. And so a complete framework needs to be introduced that that can cater for that.
So thank you very much, Alex. Thank you, Chairperson, for bringing the CMS to us. We always value this, even bringing the new register, as we work on a regulated team. There's no doubt about it, but the way you've answered some of the questions tells us that you really deserve a clean audit. So you better keep it up with the interest. I would definitely want to take up this matter of being a regulatory organization, but being able to make sure that before we get to the legal area, but we make sure that we negotiate and make sure that we are not seen as if we are abusing our power on those that we regulate. But it's not something that I mean. But I think the important thing
most of the time members of parliament are not really literate in some of the things that they handle. But I think with your help, at least I've got a lot of information that I've got from you now. And we definitely need to assist in certain things. You know, this amending these bills and making laws that are going to assist our communities to have a better healthcare, I think it's going to be important. And that's why I'm suggesting that maybe we need to meet with your legal team some other time so that they can inform us on things that they think are important. Obviously, it doesn't mean that when they tell us, we're going to do them as they're telling us. But it's something that we're going to do. But we think that there needs to be many laws or bills that are going to be formulated around making better health for the people. I can see, in a nutshell, when you talk of risk equalization and all these things, looking at those who can't afford medical but they're sick, it's going towards what the policy of the ANC is saying, talking about national health insurance. Though I wouldn't like to discuss that now, but obviously it says everybody has got the right to a healthy situation. Whether I'm sick, I'm old, I must have the right of getting a good health care. So we think that probably you're going to be assisting us in some of the things. And I'm really looking forward to that meeting that I'll organize through the register, because this is the one who's always in the office. I might talk to you, Sir President, but we want to arrange so that we can meet your legal leader, so that we can talk about this thing. And we're taking them very seriously. We understand this one of regulating the private hospital. One time I was talking in the DHF conference, I said the private healthcare industry has not been being monitored by the parliament. I think it's high time that we need to go into that area. Most of the things have been regulated except the private hospital. And you can see that they are the drivers, of course, looking at what we are showing us. They are the ones who are who are taking a lot of money out of this. So we need to find a way of regulating them. I don't know how we do it, but it's something that we need to look into as to how to regulate the private hospital industry. Obviously, we have to discuss it with the department so that we can see where we go. And I haven't forgotten about the health insurances that are going on. We need to be regulated too, but we need to make sure that the political heads of this particular department, they discuss the thing. If we did that, maybe we'll start at the level of committees discussing where does this one belong, so that we don't have a confusion about where to regulate. So these are some of the things that we need to do. Thank you very much, members. Thank you very much for your contribution. Thank you very much, CMS. After firing some people, at least we got something that has lowered our blood pressure.
I want to say thank you very much, Mr. Chairperson, for chairing the session so efficiently and effectively. Now, the conference parliament on the key issue that we have struggled with for a long, long time. I've been here a few times, and I can tell you that your interest in the level of discussion was very impressive today. And I'm very confident that we will move on the regulatory area. Just remember, when we get depressed, because often we get depressed when things don't go our way, we are a part of the process. If you look back 10 years, we've come a long, long way as a country and even in regulating the medical scheme. So what I'm saying is that as long as we move forward, and we will never solve all the problems, there will be new problems when we solve these ones. But Parliament's role is critical, and you've been wonderful in supporting us in our efforts. Thank you so much.
Yeah. Thank you very much. Maybe we must make a team.
I'll get paid for it to you.
The meeting is over.
I am the leader of the government.